So we're carrying on with the word of the Buddha. And just at the very end, it's a wonderful thing, it's in front of the screen over here. This was the end of the main part of the word of the Buddha, which was a great saying here from the Samyutta Nikaya. The Buddha asking his monks, which do you think are greater, the few leaves that I hold in my hand or all the leaves in the forest? Asked the Buddha. The leaves in the forest, came the obvious answer. Likewise, the things that I know but have not taught you are many, like the leaves in the forest, whereas the things that I have taught you are few, like the leaves in my hand. The reason that I have not taught you these things is because they are irrelevant to the holy life and do not lead to enlightenment. Because I know that people sometimes say there are hidden teachings, secret teachings of the Buddha. And this says, well, there may be hidden teachings, there may be secret teachings. The only reason they're hidden or secret is because they are irrelevant to the holy life and do not lead to enlightenment. It's a good reason to keep them secret. In other words, they're rubbish. I have to say that because sometimes people say, oh, well, in the time of the Buddha, that the people weren't, you know, intelligent enough to understand the Buddha's teachings. So he kept some teachings back until more intelligent people arose in the world. A little statement like that just is a saying from the Buddha of something completely opposite. The things he didn't teach are those things which aren't relevant to the path to enlightenment. So anyway, that's a nice little ending there. Down. Now we go into the main part of today's teachings, the gradual training. And sometimes when you look at the Buddha's teachings, what is the path to enlightenment? What do actually kind of you do? What is the direction? We always mention the Eightfold Path. That is the main description of the practice of a Buddhist towards enlightenment. But parallel to that, we've got these other description of the path, which appears in the first, in many, many suttas, but especially in the beginning of the Digha Nikaya. And it's called the gradual training. And I wanted to emphasize this is not a different path than the Eightfold Path. It's looking at it from a different angle to, in order for a person to be able to understand the Eightfold Path with much greater clarity. So it's called the gradual training. And it usually starts with the rising of the Buddha and the Dhamma. A Buddha appears in the world, accomplished, that's arahat. The word arahat means actually worthy, fully awakened, samma sambuddho. Perfect in true knowledge and conduct. It's not what one knows, but how one practices, how one speaks and walks, how one puts those ideas into physical way of life. Well liberated, knower of worlds. Knower of worlds is an important little factor here, because it's not just knowing of the human realm, but also some of the other realms, which as a monk you often get asked about, the heavenly realms, you know, the realms of spirits and ghosts and stuff, and even hell realms. An incomparable teacher of those who can be taught. I always like this expression, because it showed that even the Buddha sometimes could not teach people. And, you know, he could not teach his cousin, Devadatta. And teacher of gods and humans, the Buddha didn't just give teachings to, you know, other men and women. sometimes would give teachings to heavenly beings. I was just mentioning that to someone a couple of days ago, that when one of the heavenly beings in the suttas, they called him Sakka, and in many other traditions they called Indra, and that being, he came to see the Buddha, and it's in a cave, and the Buddha saw all these incredible lights, and then this heavenly being appeared before the Buddha and announced himself. It was a very powerful god. And then eventually, for the first time, this heavenly being could actually ask questions of a monk. Because every time before, if a heavenly being appeared here in this hall, what would you do? You would think, oh, wow, there's a heavenly being here. I can ask all my questions. And sometimes people would ask stupid questions like lottery numbers and stuff. Is that why a heavenly being would appear on earth? So you just find out lottery numbers? But the Buddha just, you know, asked who he was and welcomed him. And the heavenly being was amazed. For once, the heavenly being could ask his questions. We always thought that heavenly beings have all the wisdom, but they don't. They don't have a chance to ask questions. Because people assume, with all their power, they must know so much. So Sakka could ask the Buddha all the questions, and just having the opportunity to ask was something so rare. So, you know, sometimes it's hard to actually find someone who can teach you. And the Buddha was one of those beings, teacher of gods and the awakened one, the master, called Bhagavan, the master. It's kind of a word which I know in Mahayana Buddhism they sometimes call you master, and sometimes on arms round some of you say, hello master, and you know what I usually say to you, hello slave. Because that idea of master and subordinate, the hierarchy, is sometimes a hindrance, a barrier to teaching. But anyway, with his own direct knowledge, he has realized this universe with its gods, this world with all its beings, and he makes it known to others. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and right phrasing, and reveals a perfectly complete and pure spiritual life. And that's, sometimes you meet great monks, the people like an Ajahn Chah, and you go and listen to their teachings, and then sometimes you're dumbfounded by just how powerful they can be, but also just how they're phrased in such a good way. And later on, one of the reasons why I teach this sutta class is that sometimes when you actually have decent translations of what the Buddha said, sometimes you read it, you contemplate it, and think, oh, my goodness, how could he, you know, experience some of these amazing states of mind, great wisdoms, and be able to put it in such a gorgeous, beautiful way? I know that sometimes, like poets, I loved poetry when I was a young student, and every now and again you could get the person who has this magic with words. They can get an emotion and they can describe it so well. And that's something which inspired me again and again and again. And the Lord Buddha was like a poet of the Dhamma. How he phrased these things was just, oh, amazing. So the rising of the Buddha in the Dhamma comes first in his gradual training. Then confidence. You hear the Dhamma. On hearing the Dhamma, you acquire faith in the Buddha. Why do you get faith in anything? It's not just because it sounds nice. It's not because everybody else has confidence in this person or this teaching. It really is important that each one of us to test out our faith, to ask the tough questions, you know, to check things out, to see if this is real or not. And that's how the faith gets strengthened. Because you have to say, in this day and age, there are many teachers who can claim all sorts of things, but can they actually do that? Or is it just a means for which they can live a comfortable life? So anyway, so you hear that Dhamma, and hearing that Dhamma, you acquire faith in the Buddha. Possessing that faith, you consider thus: the household life is troublesome and busy. Life as a monastic is free and relaxed. It is not easy while living in a house to lead the holy life utterly perfect and pure. Suppose I shave off my hair, put on the orange robe, and go forth from the worldly life into a monastery. And please know, in those days, that monasteries, you know, they weren't big institutions. We try to keep everything simple. It's nice to read about some of the monasteries that used to exist in those days, just a group of caves somewhere. And sometimes they would have a hall in a place where you could go and congregate to do any ceremonies or to listen to Dhamma talks. But the rest of the time, the community would be out there in the forest or in the mountains, in the wilderness areas. You don't need much to survive if you live by yourself. And so the ideal of a monastic life has to be simplicity. And if ever any of the monasteries under the care of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia get too complicated, then if it's Bodhinyana, I've failed in my job. My job is to try and keep that simplicity there so people can come, do a lot of meditation, live simply. And so sometimes we get invitations to go somewhere and we refuse them. It's not we don't care for you, because to maintain that simplicity is an important part of the Dhamma. Household life is troublesome and busy. Life as a monastic is free and relaxed. It is not easy while living in a house to lead the holy life utterly perfect and pure. Suppose I shave off my hair, put on the orange robe, and go forth from the worldly life into a monastery. And anyone who does that, please don't take the worldly life into the monastery with you. On a later occasion, having given away all your wealth, that's an important part of it. Monastics aren't supposed to be wealthy. Once that wealth is there, you have the power to indulge. What are you indulging? Indulging your sensory desires. Oh, where am I going? Abandoning your circle of relatives and friends. It is kind of important, at least to get some distance from your relatives and friends, because the people you spend time with the most are the ones who influence you the most. So actually spending time in monasteries allow you to get some distance between, you know, those family commitments and just this other type of commitment, just called like loving kindness, where you care, but there's some things which a monk should not do. And go forth from the home life into monastic life. So once you've gone forth into monastic life, then we're talking about the virtue of monastic life. Now, most of you are not monks or nuns. Hopefully one day that will happen, if not this life and another life. But it's good you get a feeling of what a monk or a nun is all about. When you have gone forth, you train in a monastic way of life. Now this is just having gone forth. That's like papaja, like the novice ordination. And that seems to be the most important of those ordinations, the papaja and then the upasampada. The upasampada is a higher ordination. But just going forth, you have a commitment to a certain lifestyle. You abstain from killing living beings, with rod and weapon laid aside. Now the idea of Buddhist monks joining an army or nuns training in kung fu or whatever, this is not the job of a monastic. And if there was a war, you'd probably just find a nice quiet place or just give up your life. You may think I'm a crazy guy, but sometimes rather than break a rule, you just give up the life. This ideal of a monastic is just so beautiful and important. Conscientious, merciful, you live compassionate to all living beings. And so many stories about when you are compassionate to other animals, even dangerous animals, they never tend to hurt you. And sometimes you feel that, is it because I'm lucky and never been bitten by a snake or never been harmed by a tiger or over now in Jhana Grove, wild pigs? They can be dangerous. How come you've never been hurt? And of course, the most dangerous animal in the world is human beings. And they've never seemed to harass you. Because you're compassionate to all living beings, conscientious, merciful. And you abstain from taking what is not given, taking only what is given, wanting only what is given. By not stealing, you abide in purity. That's another beautiful thing. Then you realize how much you really want, how much you really need. And being a monk is not that much. You abstain from all sexual activity, living apart from others. You abstain from the lay practice of sexual intercourse. You abstain from false speech. You only speak only the truth and are trustworthy and reliable. You are no deceiver of the world. And just the idea of sexual activity, the pleasures of sensuality, you deliberately say no to those. And you live in much greater peace and happiness and more energy. You abstain from the false speech, from lying. You abstain from divisive speech. You do not tell tales in order to divide people, but you are one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, who enjoys harmony, rejoices in harmony, delights in harmony, a speaker of words that promote harmony. The divisive speech is something you can see creates so many barriers between peoples. So it's great to be able just to have this wonderful speech which encourages harmony between peoples. Not just people but people who just walk in. People of whatever age, whatever background, to have that harmony and never say things which divide people. You abstain from harsh speech. You speak only words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear and lovable. Words that go to the heart, are courteous, desired by the many, and agreeable to the many. I don't know why it is, and especially Western culture, Western culture even much more than, remember Thai culture, it's very, very rare you'd see people use bad words to one another. Honestly, maybe because I was a monk, but even in monasteries sometimes you see people losing their cool and saying all sorts of bad words to one another. They get really hot and they start calling people all sorts of really bad names. And you didn't have that at all when I was a young monk. The worst thing that people would call you is like a dog. I always remember Ajahn Chah's advice to me, if anyone does call you a dog, it means they're really upset at you in Thailand if they call you a dog. And all you need to do is to say, well, excuse me, but I've got no tail, so I can't be a dog. You were wrong. That's a way to overcome thinking you've done something wrong. check it out. And it's wonderful when you do say this courteous speech, pleasing to the ear, which goes to the heart, a courteous desired by the many. Many times on alms round, when I sort of receive people's food, I often say to people, I say, thank you, young lady, you know, for offering food today. I always tell people, especially if they're over 60, always, if they're a female, I always call them young lady. They know I'm not lying, I'm not deceiving, they know they're not a young lady anymore, just being called a young lady. It's a beautiful little gesture of kindness. Young at heart. I suppose you can be, but it's not at heart which I'm young, it's young in my glasses. So when I look at you, a few years fall off. Exactly, but that's for the eyes, the years fall off. It's bad eyesight, or it's good eyesight, depending on what you mean by good or bad. But anyway, it's just like trying to be kind. I agree with you. Let's get out of this quick. You abstain from useless speech. You speak at the proper time. Speak what is truthful. Speak on what is beneficial. Speak on the Dharma and the training at the proper time. You speak words that are worth treasuring, authoritative, succinct and beneficial. You know, sometimes people would, you know, ask me, why do you tell so many funny stories and not so funny stories, which are supposed to be funny? Why do you tell jokes? And this is words which are helpful. I saw this so many years ago, you know, when I was a lay person and going to listen to talks, you know, by famous monks or authoritative teachers. And I would see myself getting really sleepy. And I remember, just because it's another Buddhist at that time, that Professor Bernard Carr, he was a Buddhist with me when we were young, and he said sometimes he would introduce a speaker and then he would fall fast asleep. The talk was okay, but it didn't have any life in it. And I had noticed that if you really want to be able to convey the Dharma, you have to give it, you know, some examples, some interesting examples, and sometimes funny stories as well. And that would actually get the talk to become alive. And so people would remember it and they'd like to listen to it again. So that's why, you know, I worked out a long time ago that some of the funny stories and the jokes, that was actually a useful way of teaching. There's words which are worth remembering. And a few times I've done that. And I've asked the monks after the talk, I said, that was a really nice talk. And I said, what part did you remember? And they said, the jokes. But they mean more than that. Now, you abstain from injuring seeds and plants. This is not just looking after, you know, living beings, animals or insects. This is even seeds and plants we're supposed to be kind towards, not injuring them. That's one of the reasons why, as monks, we can't plant gardens. We can't do it ourselves. You practice eating only in the morning, abstaining from eating at night and outside the proper time. And this is a difficulty for many monastics, because even in the time of the Buddha, they used to say the best food is always in the evening meal. So you just eat morning times. But this was good enough to get by. You abstain from dancing, singing, music and movies. You don't see monks going to movies. And dancing and singing. If there was a video of something to do with Buddhism, fine. But you can't just go watching a movie for entertainment. And singing? You don't want to hear me singing. Even if I wasn't just recovering from a cough, the singing voice would not be that nice. So this is like the entertainment we take off. You abstain from wearing adornments, fragrances and cosmetics. You don't wear deodorant. Although I was suggesting that because there has been a drought in the southwest, and we haven't had any rain or much rain in Serpentine for a long time now, that if it continues to be dry there and there's no water for washing, then maybe deodorants may be necessary for any monk who comes to Nala Mara. But you can make that judgment. You abstain from using luxurious furnishings. Yeah, these days I do have a bed which I sleep on when I come to Nala Mara. But I think many of you have seen it. I don't think you would call it luxurious. But still over in Bodhinyana Monastery, I just sleep on the floor in my cave. And it's gorgeous. It's not luxurious, but it's simple. And that simplicity means it's easy to look after. And you don't feel you're indulging. This was a resolution I made many years ago. I don't think many of the monks remember this, because I haven't repeated it for quite a few years. I made a resolution, I will not use furnishings or stay in a hut which is more comfortable than this place of sleep of my poorest supporter. So if any of you have a bed which is more simple than the bed which I sleep on in my cave in Bodhinyana Monastery, I'll not let myself sleep in it. You're the ones who give this to me. You offer these things. And I would feel that it's not right for me to live a higher life than those who give these requisites to me. And you abstain from accepting money. I mean, I've always thought of that as a big one. Because once you accept money, you'll always find a reason for it, what I call an excuse. And if you find an excuse to have your own money, then a lot of the monastic life gets ruined. Imagine you can do whatever you want, wherever you want, and get whatever you want to eat. You know, you get a taxi to go somewhere and somebody pays for it. You don't know. There's no restraint there. I've often thought that, you know, if I need to get somewhere and I've got no money, no supporter, then do I really need to go there? A lot of time the answer is no, you don't. And you abstain from accepting raw grain and raw meat. You abstain from accepting servants and slaves. You abstain from accepting livestock. You abstain from accepting fields and land. This is where you don't, you know, have your personal business. Even fields and land, all the land at Bodhinyana Monastery, Jhana Grove, every other land, doesn't belong to me or to this monk or that monk. It belongs to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. It's a society, and so they're the ones who own things. I can't just sell Bodhinyana Monastery tomorrow and then take all the money and go and live overseas somewhere. Who would want to do that anyway? But anyway, we don't own things. And I always loved that idea. Those times when you have to try and prove that you exist, and they say, well, what do you own? Where do you live? That shows your rental agreement, shows your certificate of possession. Have you got a driving license? Have you got a car? Have you got a house? Have you got a home? Where do you live? How do you pay the rent? I don't. A monastic is just like a different animal, and it doesn't own things. And even little things like, you know, my bedding. I realized I didn't even own my blanket. When one day, just I came back from a weekend in Nolimara, and then got back late, did a few jobs, and then went to sleep. And when I woke up in the middle of the night, it was more cold than I'd expected. So I just put the light on and looked out for my blanket, and the blanket was gone. I had no blanket. Someone had took it to auction it, because my birthday was coming up soon. I don't even own my own blanket. And even sometimes my pillow changes, it disappears. And also this is other, it's a really kind of nice life. This is, you know, the shoes which I wear, these Birkenstocks. Do I choose those? Of course I don't. What I do is every, you know, once a year, I usually go to, around Christmas time, go to Penang or Kuala Lumpur. And what I do is, you know, put my shoes outside the room, you know, when they give me, and then to, you know, have a nice rest that night. And in the morning, when I wake up, there's a new pair of shoes there. This Chao Po has been doing this for years. Every year, I get a new pair of shoes. He said, well, I gave you the old ones. You don't own them, Ajahn Brahm. They belong to me. I just lend them to you for a year. And after a year, I take them back again and give you a new pair. It's kind of cute. And I abstain from going on errands and running messages. So that's not my job, if I can help. But that's not my job, to run messages or do errands. I abstain from buying and selling. Other people will be able to do that if necessary, anything which is extra for the... Even buying and selling. I just don't have a mind for money. I haven't got a clue what things are worth. To me, what things are worth is where they come from and, you know, who gave it and why they gave it. And that makes it really, really, really valuable to me. It's inherent worth I just don't get. That's just why, please, you have to look after me this way, because sometimes people give me really expensive things. This person, actually it was the same guy who gave me these Birkenstocks. He gave me a pen because he knows how many times I have to sign books. And sometimes in one night you sign over 1,000 books. That was my PB, my personal best, 1,000 books signed in 1 hour. Oh, my arm was so sore. But at least I had a good pen to sign those books. And I didn't know, they just gave me this pen and I just signed the books. And then when I got to Singapore, one of the Singaporeans said, Ajahn Brahm, what are you doing with a Mont Blanc pen? Apparently Mont Blanc is like designer pen. I haven't got a clue what it's worth. All I knew was it worked and was reliable. So I had to give that up. So, buying and selling. You abstain from practicing fraud. I can't understand why people practice fraud. For whatever reason, it just makes no sense to me. Someone is going to get, when they find out, they're going to be upset they've got something which wasn't worth anything. And also, they will never trust you again. So fraud doesn't make any sense to me. You abstain from accepting bribes, deceiving, defrauding, and trickery. You know, you can see that sometimes people in power, sometimes they can very easily just succumb to the temptation of this money. When you don't have a bank account, you don't have a slush fund, I wouldn't know what to do with the money. You abstain from wounding, murdering, imprisoning, extortion, plunder and violence, especially violence. Venerable Metaji was talking to me today that this weekend there's lots of demonstration about domestic violence. And it's gross. And I must admit that when I was growing up, my mother and father, yeah, they had arguments, but I never saw one event of domestic violence. My father could not hit my mother. He couldn't hit me either. And remember afterwards when I found out why he was so soft. And he said that because he was the youngest of many children in Liverpool, and his father would come home drunk, take off his belt, and just hit anybody, the first person he saw. Sometimes my father was on the end of that belting. And then he would set on his wife, my dad's mum. And that hurt him more than anything. He couldn't protect his own mother from the domestic violence from his own father. And he made a vow. I remember him telling me this. He made a vow if ever he survived, and if ever he had a family himself, he would never hit his kids or his wife. And you've got to say that he never did. All those years which we lived in this very small apartment, never saw any domestic violence. I was fortunate. When you see what happens when there is domestic violence, what happens when there isn't, it's obvious why you would try and never ever condone things like violence. So that becomes just some of the core for the rules of discipline of monks. You know, the simplicity, the softness, the kindness. And next we come up to contentment. And you become content with patched robes to protect your body and with alms food to maintain your stomach. And wherever you go, you travel taking only these with you. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden, so too you become content with patched robes to protect this body and with alms food to maintain your stomach. And wherever you go, you travel taking only these with you. I've been a monk for almost 50 years now, and that phrase there always inspires me. And in fact, you can live a simple life. And I try and do that the best I can. This is more than I usually take overseas, because I'm taking some stuff down to Serpentine. But you try and have so few things, and you don't need so many things. This is a noble virtue and contentment, and you experience within yourself a delightful bliss, the joy of being blameless. No one criticizes you. You have few possessions. There's a lot of people these days, as they always have done, they're trying to do something about lessening the carbon footprint of human beings. And one of those is learning how to live with less. How many things do you need? And we're trying to lessen our burdens. And part of my job is to actually to almost show by example how little you need. That's contentment. Now we have restraint of the senses, simplicity, and the happiness with the simple things which you have. When you're content like that, sometimes I feel, you know, like these really wealthy people in this world. I've made it. I've got a few things and I'm happy with them. I don't need any more. So it's drawing to the senses. When you see an object, this is actually how restraint works. You see something. You do not let yourself get sucked in by marks and features that generate defilements. Since if you left the faculty of sight unrestrained, unskillful states of wanting and aversion would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom when seeing. You guard the faculty of sight. You undertake the restraint of sight. I used to notice when somebody would drive me in from Bodhinyana into Nolamara on a Friday afternoon. It's a Friday afternoon, and sometimes it's very warm. And I remember a place just before Armidale, there was always an ice cream van there. It was in the afternoon. And I'm not allowed to eat ice cream in the afternoon. But when I saw it, I really wanted it. During the morning, I wasn't interested. And that's the things like that you start to doubt, you know, all these wanting. A lot of times you want it because you can't have it. And that was the cause of the wanting it. And after a while you say, what am I doing this for? After a while you just don't even look at the ice cream van. And you practice wisdom when seeing. What do I want that for? So you undertake the restraint of sight. Having heard a sound, having noticed a smell, having sensed a taste, having felt a bodily feeling, having cognized something in the mind, you do not let yourself get sucked in by marks and features that generate defilements. Since if you let the mind faculty unrestrained, unskillful states of wanting and aversion would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom with the mind. You guard the mind, and you undertake the restraint of the mind. Why did I want those sense pleasures or those sensory experience anyway? You always feel they're going to give you the pleasure and satisfaction. But they are unfaithful to their promises. They like market themselves. Say, once you get this, then you'll be happy. The best simile for that, which I only mentioned a few weeks ago, so I'm sure you remember it, but it's such a great symbol, it's worth keeping in mind, was the Nasruddin story. Nasruddin was eating a big bag of chili peppers. And if you eat chili peppers, just raw chili, then of course, you know, your face goes red, you know, snot comes from your nose and your eyes start watering. It's very unpleasant. When his friends saw him eating so many chili peppers, they asked him, what are you doing that for? And he said, I'm looking for the sweet one. I love that story when somebody gets married again. What are you doing that for? I'm looking for the sweet one. Please excuse me, but I'm honest. The sweet ones. It's chili peppers. They're hot. And so sometimes you don't follow what other people do. You use your own wisdom. And you find you live a much more peaceful life. It gets much easier. I got clear comprehension. To get the deep meditations. When you restrain the senses, you find you don't have much old business to deal with, you're not searching for new business, your mind is pretty peaceful. So the guarding of the mind is really important. When you follow this noble restraint of the senses, you experience within yourself an even more delightful bliss the joy of being unagitated. The unagitated happiness, which is the Anenja Sukha, I think. But anyway, you do this, and this is not a hard thing to do. The reason I say that is because when you practice the virtue and contentment, the idea, the joy of being blameless, that is a joy, you can feel it. You're a happier person. And it becomes by, you look at your conduct, you've done nothing which will harm any other being, nothing to feel ashamed of, nothing which is going to possibly give any bad karma for you. You feel like free of all of this problems which people have to deal with in life. And the restraint of the senses, that gives you a being unagitated. Your senses aren't disturbing you. So you're a peaceful person. So you get a deep sense of spiritual happiness through this. And then the clear comprehension. Now straight away we've already the clear comprehension, sampajanya, this is almost is actually part of sati, part of mindfulness. But it's actually put in a separate little compartment over here. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when going forward and returning. Why are you walking forward? What's the purpose of this? Are you just walking just to waste time? Or just walking just to go and spot something or see something? You've got an idea. If you've not got an idea of why you should be walking, you sit still. You act in full comprehension of the purpose when looking ahead and looking away, when flexing and extending your limbs, when wearing your clothes and carrying things. Why are you doing this for? I know sometimes that when I'm helping somebody else and quite busy, sometimes this is a very long robe and sometimes it falls to the ground a bit. But what's the purpose of me wearing my robes? If I'm going forward, sometimes the helping somebody else is more important than me being photogenic and being a monk who's got restrained robes. I've got other things which at that time are more important. You know, helping somebody. I don't know what I'm doing this for. You act in full comprehension of the purpose regarding eating. You're not eating too much. Drinking, defecating and urinating. Walking, standing, sitting, sleeping. When you're sleeping, why are you sleeping? What's the purpose of it? Recently, I deliberately tried to sleep more because I was sick. And of course it works. But now I'm reasonably healthy, I'll sleep much less. What's the purpose of being awake? What's the purpose of talking? What's the purpose of being silent? So these are the actions which you do. You understand the question, why? And then, when you have developed this noble virtue, this noble restraint of the sense faculties, and this noble clear comprehension, you go to a secluded dwelling place, such as the forest, the foot of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw. The only thing which is important for each one of those is secluded. And sometimes they say like comfortable, so you don't have lots of bugs, like mosquitoes or sandflies causing you any problems. You don't sit in a place where there's lots of ants. So you sit in a place which is secluded and comfortable. You sit down, folding your legs crosswise, straightening the body and establishing mindfulness as a priority. It usually does say folding legs crosswise, but if you are elderly or if you are sickly, sitting on a chair is more than good enough. It's one of the reasons why it was a wonderful thing when Buddhism did come to Western countries, and we knew that we can't get everybody sitting in full lotus on the floor. It would just, if you're very young, fine. But there's so many people who'd never be able to meditate like that. So we had like cushions and little stools and chairs. Wonderful. The whole point is you can sit stable, content, pain-free for long periods of time. The most important part of this is you establish mindfulness as a priority. And I think you all know where this one comes from. Sometimes they would say, establishing mindfulness in front of you. And that just made no sense at all. It does mean mindfulness as number one. And then, abandoning, wanting for the world of the five senses. You've already practiced a lot of restraint. Now, anything to do with your five senses and the five sense world, any desires which come from that, you abandon those. You abide with the mind free from wanting. You purify the mind from desire. Remember, you've already done the sense restraint. You've already done the contentment with few things. So that's much easier to do, you know, when you're abandoning wanting for the world of the five senses. You abandon aversion. You abide with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. You thus purify the mind from aversion. Abandoning dullness and drowsiness. You abide with a mind free from dullness and drowsiness, bright-minded, clearly comprehending. You purify the mind from dullness and drowsiness. And it doesn't say here you just generate energy by taking a Red Bull, an energy drink. You just abandon that through wisdom, not wasting energy, and soon you understand how to create energy and to guard it. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated, with the mind inwardly peaceful. You purify the mind from restlessness and remorse. And you abandoning doubt, you abide having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. You purify the mind from doubt. These are what we call the five hindrances, specifically mentioned in this path. And the jhanas. These are not things which I've added here and added here. This is the standard descriptions. Having abandoned the five hindrances, totally free from the five senses, free from unwholesome states, you enter upon an abide in the first jhana, wherein the mind moves onto the object and holds onto it. The object being joy and pleasure, caused by being totally free from the five senses. When the mind stops moving onto the object and stops holding onto it, you enter upon the abide in the second jhana, which has trust in the object, the bliss, enough to let go of holding it. It stays by itself. And unity of mind, without any movement or holding, with joy and pleasure caused by perfect stillness. These are bliss states, not small things. With the fading away of joy, you abide mindful and fully aware. You experience a bliss purified from joy. You enter upon and abide in the third jhana, on account of which noble ones announce, one has a pleasant abiding indeed, who has such mindfulness and equanimity. Having abandoned pleasure and pain, that's all Vedana from the five senses, with disappearance of joy and grief, or Vedana from the sixth sense, except for equanimity, you enter upon abide in the fourth jhana, which is only neutral mental Vedana, remaining just pure mindfulness with equanimity. That is the gradual training, an equivalent to the Eightfold Path. And one of the points I always wanted to emphasize in this teaching is very often I was really confused with the right effort. How come this right effort? You're supposed to do something in meditation? And when you see this sense restraint, this is the equivalent of the right effort in the Eightfold Path. The contentment and sense restraint means it becomes a natural letting go of these things which, you know, causes excitement, wanting, and then disappointment. It gives a much deeper understanding of what the right effort, the Samavayama, really is in the Eightfold Path. All the other parts you can see quite clearly are the same. But it just adds an extra little bit so you can know what this Eightfold Path really is. Please excuse me for doing all the talking. But now is an opportunity for your questions.
I'd like to ask probably a very simple question, but why is it that the monks can only eat in the morning?
Why they can only eat in the morning? Because it becomes simple, and you eat in the morning, and basically it gets it out of the way, so you have the rest of the day totally free. And if it's in the afternoon or evening, you find that, you know, the people of the world is much busier in the afternoon or evening, especially at night time. You know, the evening meal can sometimes be a very sensuous thing. Now, if you go out sort of courting, you know, you go and take your girlfriend to an evening dinner. How many people actually just, you know, make a date with someone? Let's come to go to breakfast tomorrow morning. The evening and afternoon in most cultures is much more sensuous. At least that's my idea anyway, I'm not sure. But anyway, that's what has been done for a long time. I must admit there was one monk who came here years ago. I kind of really respected him. He got permission from one of the senior monks, so they knew what he was up to. He's not trying to cheat or anything. He was staying over in the United States and he said, can I just try this for a month? Now, I'm only going to eat once a day, but in the evening, just to see how it goes. Because the main part of just eating in the morning is just simplifying it, eating just one simple meal and that's it. So he got permission to do that. But he said, you know, just, so he didn't eat in the morning, didn't eat in the afternoon, just ate in the evening. Now everybody knew what he was doing. It was almost like an experiment. And he did notice that it was much more, again, sensuous in the evening. When he went to somebody's house, you know, lots more people were around. Somebody was next door watching the TV. Somebody was listening to some music. In the morning time in those days, he didn't even have TV programs. I mean, when I got up, the TV started at 4 p.m. or 5 p.m. or something. He didn't have much music at all. It's much more restrained in the morning time. That's the only possibility I know of.
Thank you.
That makes sense to you.
Okay. Really? Maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but...
Sorry?
Maybe 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I could understand, you know, sort of perhaps after then not eating, but
yeah.
eating only in the morning and then not anything after that, it sort of doesn't make sense to me.
Okay.
But that's me.
Well, I must admit, though, that having done it for so many years, you know, if you can get your meal really early, you know, then you don't have anything else to do. And your tummy is nice and relaxed, so you can meditate much more deeply. Filling your tummy up with energy, you usually have to put the fuel in the car before you set off on the journey. And then you can have a nice meditate all day and have a great time. Anyway.
Can I ask a question to Ajahn?
Yeah, certainly.
From the lay perspective, about self-defence. So you talked there about, you know, monks, say if, you know, something happens, monks would, you know, give up the rod and sword and just give up their life.
Yes.
And something I've thought about more recently, I guess, you know, being a parent and I guess, you know, looking after myself, my family or community. If something, you know, someone came to attack. I guess, you know, what would you say about that in terms of a lay person with this kind of responsibility to others, caring for others and self-defence?
That changes the perspective when you have a family, you've got a little kid you're responsible for. So the best thing there is to try and protect the house so it's as safe as possible. But if somebody ever attacks your kid, you know, please, you have to do the restraint. Something inside of you tells you I must protect. But do it with the least violence possible. Speaking especially for a monk should not get involved, you know, in any violence at all. And I don't know, as a monk, weird things happen. The weird things happen is a few times that instead of protecting myself, you know, that you just stood in front of this guy in this road over here years and years ago when we were building this place. And, you know, he came up to me and said, I'm looking for the bloke in charge, I'm looking for the bloke in charge. He came out of the pub and he just wanted to punch my lights out. He was standing right in front of me and his fist was right in front of my nose. And I wasn't afraid. I had enough sense of restraint, have no fear, but also have no arrogance. I just was looking him in the eye and peacefully. And he was just like frozen. It was a weird experience, which I'll never forget. I remember afterwards there were many people here watching me. Not one of them came to help me. They didn't need to. And there were just a few minutes it took. Just they had a big delivery of chairs, and they parked the van, and the boss came out of the car and said, come on, we'll unload the chairs. I said, yeah, I'll come and help you. So we unloaded them together. There was no violence. It was amazing, you can diffuse violence. And one of the monks from here, when he disrobed, he was an amazing young man, because I remember that he was from UK, from over in south of London, a really rough school he went to, and he managed to show us his report card, how many times he'd been expelled or put under suspension. He was a really rough character, but so nice. And after he was a monk for a while, he got a job as a bouncer in a nightclub. And I thought that was really weird. But then I said, that's a violent job. He said, oh, I never use violence. He learnt enough as a monk of how to diffuse situations. He never needed to use violence. And I was really quite proud of him. Eventually he got married and I went to his marriage ceremony. He married a lovely school teacher and he was a really good guy. So, but he never needed violence, even getting a job as a bouncer in a nightclub. It's good money. All he did was standing around all day or at night time and just diffusing situations rather than inflaming them. But I can understand if you are a parent and it's your child is being threatened, of course you'd be willing to sacrifice your life for your child.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Ajahn.
Yeah. Any other questions anyone's got?
Ajahn, at the start you said that even the Buddha couldn't teach some people.
Yeah.
So does that mean even if that person came in contact with the Buddha that the seeds of the Dhamma wouldn't be planted in them?
Ah, that's a good question. Because of course seeds of the Dhamma would be planted there. But then a start would happen. But he couldn't really take that teaching to fulfillment. And this is one other thing which I noticed personally. I've mentioned it before. A monk is unable to teach his mother. I tried that with my own mum, to teach her some Dhamma. It just wouldn't work. And Sariputta couldn't teach his mother. And I remember even this Australian monk coming to Thailand and ordaining in Thailand, his mother visited. And then he tried to teach her some Dhamma meditation, it wouldn't work. And he asked me, can you teach my mum a few things about Buddhism? And she took to it so easily. And it wasn't I was a great teacher at that time. It was just because, that a mother, you and Alia, that can Alia teach you meditation? Never be able to. Simply because, that the mother and child, you've been her teacher from when she was still in the womb. So that's something which you need somebody else to do that teaching. Same with your kid. It's good you got a book from me the other day to give to your kid. That would work, but you won't be able to teach him. Inspire him, yes, but not really teach him. So no, the other way around, so you'll be able to teach. What am I talking about? No, he will never be able to teach you. Okay, any other questions?
In your previous teachings, so you have, I remember the phrase, when it comes to sense restraint, I remember the phrase that you said was from Buddha was appasukha bahudukha.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So if you put it into a people like us, if you watch a movie or listening to a song, so that's five senses, indulging in five senses. So what is the bahudukha in there? Or the suffering in there?
The suffering there is also that you always need more. You always need more of the same. It's always demanding more sensory pleasure. And in the end it doesn't really satisfy. If it satisfies, you're full. You don't need any more. You have to have something afterwards, something afterwards, something afterwards. It never really satisfies.
And thereby wasting time that you can practice?
You have a much better happiness. Yeah. You're sacrificing a big happiness by indulging in a small happiness.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense.
Thank you. Sorry, Ajahn, just a question on the translation of the word Bhagava.
Oh, yes.
At the very beginning, I think you used the word master, Ajahn,
yeah.
That one. And I think Bhagava, what I have seen is sometimes the Lord and other times the Blessed One. I thought Blessed One because the Bhagava, because he is blessed with all these things, that the ability to see, ability to teach, ability to all the 10 powers. And yeah. So I thought, I'm sorry, but the Blessed One blessed the Master and all.
It's one of those one of those things which, in the end, I just go back to the original Pali and just call Bhagava, because it's not an important thing, but the idea of Blessed One, and blessed by who? Blessed himself.
Yeah, by
that's why sometimes you sneeze and say, bless you.
No, by his own previous actions, previous karma.
Was it?
Yes.
Or was
that's
it?
What the, that's what the commentaries say, Ajahn. I know you wouldn't rely very much on the commentaries, but...
Well, wouldn't you sort of say he was blessed by living with Kassapa the Buddha in a previous life?
Yes. Previous karma?
Yes.
Being the Gatikar?
Yes. Fortunate one.
Fortunate one. Yeah, that's another translation, fortunate yeah. one. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other one, I also that Ajahn, in somewhere there was that sentence, leaving a group of relatives or a fortune. I think if I remember right, that that's at the beginning, I think. Not afterwards, little bit lower down and below the virtue, and I think it's in Pabbaja section, I think, leaving, going for, no, before that, I think, sorry, right at the top, I think, then.
Huh.
That it says, I think normally, I think what I have read there is that, I think you read that earlier, maybe you have changed that, leaving a small or large group of relatives.
Or friends, yes.
Yeah, or leaving a small or large fortune. So, and I think you omitted that small or large. So I thought in the Latukikopama Sutta that the Buddha explains that what it means, small and large.
Giving away all your wealth.
Later occasion, having given away all your wealth, abandoning the circle of relatives and friends. So small or large, whether that fetter, someone, a small thing is a fetter, but whereas a bigger thing is not a fetter to another person, that...
Oh yes, but they're all possible fetters. So it's best to give the whole lot away. Then there's no argument.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. I am going over time. So, again, thank you all for listening. And I hopefully you found some meaning in it.